May it please the court. I'm Doug Barlow, and along with Mr. Robert Morrow, we were appointed under the Criminal Justice Act to represent Mr. David Lee Jackson during the trial of his capital murder allegation, as well as on appeal. I'd like to begin by directing the court's attention to our issues 1, 2, and 3 regarding the pretrial delay, and then secondly, I'd like to discuss issue number 13 regarding the impeachment of witness Agovsky. Regarding the pretrial delay, it's the court's well aware that the offense date was back in December of 1999 when the capital murder allegation arose out of the Beaumont prison. The indictment was not returned until almost 6 years later in April of 2005. Mr. Jackson asserted some of his rights during the early investigation and even requested counsel as early as 2000, but that was dismissed as being premature. And I believe under the record we can show that he's suffered demonstrable prejudice and harm from the delay that was occasioned by the conduct of the government. Of course, the relevant authorities are cited in the briefs. The Crouch case stands for the proposition that it's necessary for us to show bad faith on the part of the government in order to establish a denial of due process. We submit that under the record in this case, though, that a real strict application of the Crouch case affords the government actually complete control over the issue, because it's difficult when the government won't respond at the pretrial hearings. It's difficult for us to see what's in the mind of the prosecutors. And that's basically what the government has done during the pretrial hearings, is despite the fact that the government doesn't share the constitutional rights of Mr. Jackson, the government basically still takes the fifth when asked what's their response to our allegations about why there was such a pretrial delay. The government at the pretrial hearings has systematically refused to respond to what we believe is the reason for the pretrial delay, other than just some general denials. And what do we submit is the logical explanation of why there was such a delay of almost 6 years in proceeding with the capital murder allegation? And what was the government's prohibited behavior? One of the most contested issues at the trial was who had what weapon. Mr. Jackson was tried after co-defendant Gully. The court's already responded to a similar issue in Mr. Gully's case, but we can distinguish Mr. Jackson's. One of the significant issues was who had the weapon, who had held the knife that caused the fatal blow. The government even called experts, put on expert testimony to establish that Mr. Jackson and not Mr. Gully was the one that had the weapon that caused the death. This was after an extensive investigation that went on for some 4 years before the first charge was brought, and that was when the defendants were charged with possession of weapons in the institution in November of 2003 rather than capital murder. We submit that the government in 2005 didn't just suddenly discover that a capital murder had occurred. We submit that was a tactic by the government to put the weapon in the hands of the person that they wanted to convict of capital murder and seek a death sentence on. What better way to prove who caused the fatal blow than to have a defendant plead guilty to possession of the weapon that caused the fatal injury? The government would also be well aware that any subsequent prosecution for capital murder after the weapons case concluded would not be precluded under jeopardy, or would certainly pass the Blockberger test as containing additional and different allegations. But the only problem that accrued to the government was that the defendants refused to plead guilty. Mr. Jackson did not plead guilty to the weapons charge, so that was ultimately dismissed.
So how has there been prejudice if this was an elaborate ruse to get him to plead guilty and then use that against him in the capital murder? Then how has he been prejudiced since he didn't plead guilty?
The way he was prejudiced is because of the delay, Your Honor. The delay caused him prejudice and harm because there was some allegation of some missing witnesses, at least one witness that we were unable to locate. There was some evidence that there had been a videotape that had perhaps been lost. That was.
But did that occur after the weapons charge was dismissed or before? I mean, when did this loss occur?
All of that, and the most significant point, I'm
Well, the death, I understand, of the mother, but the The loss of the sort of physical evidence, when did that occur?
We cannot pinpoint when the videotape was lost. The witness that said he just didn't know, couldn't explain about the videotape. And the missing witness is the reason that occurred is because we didn't get involved until he was charged with capital murder, and there were just witnesses that our investigators said they were unable to locate.
Okay.
So that happened in the...
But we don't know whether they could have been located had they proceeded on the capital murder charge rather than the weapons charge in 03.
That's correct.
Okay.
We also submit that if there was a fair and reasonable explanation of why the government delayed so long and why the government initially charged them with weapons offenses and then dismissed it later, then the government certainly seems, if there was a plausible explanation, the government should have offered it at the pretrial hearings or explained it to the trial court. But to date, the government's response has basically been no response, Your Honor. That's what's even quoted in the brief when the prosecutor at trial was asked, do you have a response to these allegations of the defense, and simply say we have no response.
And what did we can check the record, of course, but what did the district court say to that?
The district court just simply denied the relief that we requested on dismissal for mm-hmm. pretrial delay. That's another thing that we wanted to bring up is the trial court didn't encourage the prosecutor to respond or can you explain to us anything about why the weapons case was dismissed?
Yeah, that was really my question, whether the court followed up with any.
Did not. Okay. There's been no explanation at the hearings from the prosecution. In fact, it was like the elephant in the courtroom that the government was just allowed to ignore. You know, they didn't have to say why they filed weapons charges and then dismissed them later. We submit also that requiring a strict application of the Crouch case, requiring us to prove exactly what's in the mind of a prosecutor sets an impossible burden for us. If we've offered reasonable explanations of what we think the cause for the delay was and we can't get into the mind of the prosecutor, then there'd be no way to meet our burden.
But we're not free to, as a panel, overrule Crouch. I mean, you're not asking us to do that, are you?
No, Your Honor. I think I'm just saying that limited to the facts of this particular situation that we've demonstrated prejudice and likely improper behavior on the part of the government. And the harm that accrued to Mr. Jackson is readily apparent from the missing witnesses, but most critical was during the pretrial proceedings, the most critical witness regarding the punishment phase was Mr. Jackson's mother, who unexpectedly passed away during pretrial before we got to trial, and the court's response, and we even brought that up and said, look what harm we've now that's been foisted on the defense. In a capital murder case, our most important witness has passed away, and the court simply said we should have taken her deposition earlier and should have anticipated that, when we certainly don't presume based on the age of a witness.
You know, I understand the desire of a defendant to have his mother plead for his life if you get to a punishment phase in a capital case. I'm wondering, though, are there no other relatives and people who, A, could plead for his life, and, B, could speak to any problems in his background that would be mitigating circumstances, this very extensive list of mitigating circumstances that was submitted to the jury for consideration?
Well, we could locate no other family members, and it's basically because of what the mitigation specialist set out, and the government was able to take advantage of us in that regard, too. The mitigation specialist set out just the terrible life he had, the family members that had been incarcerated or were all on drugs and were unavailable or had passed away. The only person we were able to locate was a girlfriend, wife/girlfriend that had known him since childhood and hadn't seen him for many, many years. She came and she was able to relate most of the background information that the mitigation specialist used. But then the government, because the mother had passed away, and we submit that the mother's not there just to plead for his life. The mother is there because she, better than any person, could describe all the abuse, how his father led him into a life of crime, the neglect, everything that he suffered as a child. But the government was then allowed to argue that that was uncorroborated, that we didn't hear from anybody else to support what this mitigation specialist is telling the jury now, and we submit that the person that could have corroborated that is the person that died, because we were going to trial years after
that. Was the jury made aware that the mother had died?
I don't recall that specifically.
Were you precluded from telling them that?
No, I don't think we were not precluded from telling that, and that probably did come out, but I just don't recall. So the government was able to take advantage of that delay by the fact that our witness, our most important witness at punishment, was missing, and even argued that, well, there's no corroboration of what the defense is trying to tell you to save his life. I'd like to also address briefly the issue number 13, which is somewhat of a novel issue, I believe, and that's the impeachment of witness Shannon Ogofsky. As the court's aware, Mr. Ogofsky had been previously convicted and sentenced to death in two counts of capital murder with two death sentences, and this court reversed that. Shannon Ogofsky was the most critical witness at the guilt or innocence stage because we saved him for last for this reason. He knew more about the facts, about what happened on the yard out there in that prison in Beaumont. He knew what Darryl Brown, the alleged victim, what he had said and done, and his attitude towards Mr. Jackson. He was present and saw when the assaultive behavior of Mr. Darryl Brown began on Mr. Jackson, and he was basically knew more facts than anybody. That's why we saved him for last, because he was such an important witness. Over our pointed objections, his testimony was impeached by the government being allowed to tell the jury that he had two prior capital murder convictions and two death sentences, both of which had at that point been reversed by this court. The prosecution tried to argue that the convictions were not reversed, only the sentences were reversed, but the court got a hold of this court's opinion and saw that, in fact, the convictions had been reversed. But the mandates had not issued yet. The mandates had not been issued. And that was something important to the trial court, but we submit that that's not the critical issue.
But wasn't there a petition for certiorari pending?
There was.
And that's why the mandate was held.
That's correct, Your
Honor. And so then is that a pendency of an appeal that plays into, 609E?
The reason I think 609 is 609 stands for the notion that we should not, just because a case is on appeal, we should not presume that the case is going to get reversed. You should presume the opposite. It's the notion that the presumption of regularity and correctness, that we think cases are not going to likely get reversed. But that same notion should apply when this court has ruled. When this court has already ruled, then that presumption should apply that
we appreciate that.
That the ruling of this court is correct, and that we should presume that the ruling of this court is not going to get reversed or changed later. And that's the theory behind it, is of 609, is that just because somebody appeals, that doesn't mean that their case is going to get reversed. Well,
you are entirely right about that an opinion of this court is a judgment from the day it's entered, and the pendency of a mandate or of certiorari does not affect certainly the precedential effect of it, and it is a judgment. So I hope the government will be ready to address that.
And we think it's important because the notion of the rule is that you should give deference to a trial court judgment. That same notion should apply, that you should give deference to the ruling of this court. And it isn't as if this happened in the dark, that it happened by mistake or we didn't know what was going to happen. It was everybody with their eyes wide open knew that this court had reversed those two death sentences and convictions, and yet the court admitted them both, knowing full well that only one of them, and we didn't even know at that time which one, could be valid. We knew one of them was not going to be a valid conviction.
But that does raise the point of, we know one of them was going to be valid because the reversal wasn't a reversal of the entire thing and now this defendant's going to be set free and so forth. It was a reversal because you couldn't have the two convictions. And so if we're analyzing this, if we're looking for whether this is an error that made a difference, assuming it is an error, did it make a difference?
It did, Your Honor.
Given that he was, in fact, convicted ultimately of the one count.
Two death sentences and convictions of capital murder are worse than one. And the comment of the prosecutor is telling when we were discussing whether Mr. Ogofsky was going to be chained or not in the courtroom, when the prosecutor said he wasn't really concerned about the chains. The jury is going to know that this defendant has been convicted of two capital murders. So the fact that he's in chains, I think, is not going to weigh very heavily on the opinion of him. The prosecution knew how damaging two capital murder convictions
were. But two versus one? I mean, are you saying the jury would have said, well, we can believe this guy if he only has one capital murder conviction, but now that it's two, I mean, is that the distinction, two versus one, or is it two versus none that is the distinction?
Well, at that point, neither should have been admitted because both had been reversed. There was no valid conviction if they...
No, I understand that, but when we're looking at harmfulness of the error, I think that's what my question is directed to. You're saying it's a big deal that it's two, and I'm saying, well, is two versus none might be a big deal, but two versus one, I don't know. That's what I'm asking you.
We submit that, yes, in prosecutors count the number of convictions people have to enhance sentences in front of a jury. That does have an impact.
All right. Your initial time has expired. You've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Barlow. Ms. Kenner.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'll address the issues in the same order that Mr. Barlow addressed them, turning first to the issue regarding pre-indictment delay, and then to the impeachment of Shannon Wlanogowski, and then to any other issues that the court cares to address. With respect to the issue regarding pre-indictment delay, the trial court applied the appropriate standard in here when Mr. Jackson raised this pre-trial. She recognized that it was incumbent upon the defendant to prove both actual and substantial harm, as well as an improper purpose or a delay, or a tactical advantage gained by the government resulting from a pre-indictment delay. In this case, the court found that Mr. Jackson did not meet the burden on either case, and so she did not order pretrial discovery. She did, however, carry the motion regarding to dismiss the indictment for pre-indictment delay throughout the trial to determine whether there was indeed prejudice that Mr. Jackson could prove from the pre-indictment delay.
Is it the case that the government would not answer the question as to the reason?
The government provided three reasons to the court in its written response to Mr. Jackson's motion for pre-indictment delay. The three reasons, which were legitimate in our mind, were, first of all, lack of investigative and prosecutorial resources, the length of scientific testing, and the death penalty protocol under the Federal Death Penalty Act. And I'll address each one of those. With respect to the lack of prosecutorial or investigative resources, the Beaumont Penitentiary had been opened, I believe, shortly before 1999, within 2 or 3 years. At that time, a number of violent inmates were transferred to USP Beaumont. And within a relatively short time, they began committing violent acts. And we have had several death penalty cases arise from conduct of the inmates at USP Beaumont. In fact, Mr. Rogowski was another one of the inmates that was prosecuted for a murder that he committed while at USP Beaumont, and his case actually went before Mr. Jackson's case. Our resources have been strained by our capital murder prosecutions arising from USP Beaumont. In fact, although this is outside of the record, our U.S. attorney was in D.C. within the last couple of weeks requesting more resources to prosecute capital cases because we do have a very heavy load. And these cases do consume a lot of time by the prosecutor as well as the investigators. I believe it was in the McDonald case, which I have cited in our brief, although it's a Sixth Amendment case, where the Supreme Court noted that it declined to criticize the government for exercising care and caution and thought in charging a young doctor with the murder of his wife and two small children. In this case, the government is not going to apologize for exercising care and caution and thought before we charge someone with the death penalty and seek a death sentence.
6 years is a long time, though.
It is a long time, yes, Your Honor, but it was within the statute of limitations. And there was a lengthy amount of time, and the caseloads regarding the other death penalty cases. Also, we do have the Speedy Trial Act, which makes it incumbent upon us to be ready to go to trial within 70 days of indictment. And the defendants in death penalty cases tend to not exercise their right to a speedy trial, but they could make the tactical decision that they want to go to trial within the 70 days. And if they do, we have to be ready when we indict to prosecute the case. So there is that preparation, as well as there getting approval for a death penalty does take some time under the federal death penalty protocol established by the federal government. So each of these reasons were actually legitimate. Also, the trial court was not considering this within a vacuum. She had addressed this identical issue when Mr. Gulley raised it before his trial. Mr. Gulley was indicted with Mr. Jackson, but we did not seek the death penalty against him. The parties sought a severance, which was granted, and Mr. Gulley's trial went first. Mr. Gulley also somewhat ironically raised the issue of pre-indictment delay. The pre-indictment delay actually benefited him because we decided not to seek the death penalty in his case. But he did raise it, so the court had considered the same claim in Mr. Gulley's case. The trial court, after looking at the reasons that Mr. Jackson offered trying to demonstrate harm, and balancing them against the reasons offered by the government, decided that the discovery was not necessary and that Mr. Jackson had not shown actual or substantial harm. Analyzing the reasons given by Mr. Jackson, first of all, there was no proof or no evidence of what steps they had taken to find the missing witness. The court pointed out to them. Also, the private investigator's summary of what the witness would testify appeared to be hearsay from another witness that had testified in Mr. Gulley's case and was anticipated to testify in this case. So it's unlikely that the missing witness would have been able to offer anything that was not offered during the trial. With respect to the videotapes, Mr. Jackson alleged that there were two videotapes that were missing, one of which was presumably from a guard tower, and the other which involved some sort of summit in between inmates from New York and inmates from Detroit at USP Beaumont. The court had heard evidence regarding these during Mr. Gulley's trial as well. The evidence at this trial demonstrated that there was no camera on the guard tower at the time in question, which would have been December of 1999. That had really become an issue in Mr. Gulley's case because one of the guards or one of the witnesses seemed to remember that there might have been a videotape on the guard tower. We had verified that, and the testimony at Mr. Jackson's trial was unequivocal that there was no camera on the guard tower at the time in question. Moreover, even if there had been, it would not have shown the area where this fight began because the view was obstructed by one of the buildings. But the testimony from, and I believe it was Mr. Derek Wilson, our first witness, established that there simply was not a videotape from the guard tower. At this trial, there was absolutely no evidence of any kind of summit between the inmates from Detroit and the inmates from New York, much less one that was taped. As to our knowledge, although this is somewhat outside the record, there simply was no summit and there was no videotape of it. With respect to Mr. Jackson's mother, it's unfortunate that she passed away before his trial. Mr. Jackson had, though, requested a motion to depose her because she was, I believe, 78 years old, and we did not oppose it. Then there was some delay before taking the deposition, and she died within the delay. While that's unfortunate, it was not the government's fault that Mr. Jackson's mother passed away, and we had not opposed the right to depose her. Additionally, her testimony would have been in mitigation. While it would have been obviously powerful, the mitigation testimony was provided by someone who apparently did love Mr. Jackson very dearly and had loved him from the time he was a child, and she gave objective testimony about her observations from his family. Now, the jury may have chosen not to believe them, and yes, we did cross-examine her on that, but that does not mean that he was not unable to present that testimony. I also believe that he had listed another family member as a potential witness in the witness list that are part of the record in this case. And for some reason, that family member was not called. No. Turning now to Mr. Rogowski's impeachment. This case was in an unusual situation. A panel of this court had evaluated Mr. Rogowski's convictions, and under the Federal Death Penalty Act standards of review, I'm sure had reviewed them for evidence. and had found that the government had violated double jeopardy in charging him for capital murder under 10118, which is murder by a federal prisoner serving a sentence of imprisonment for life, as well as first-degree murder under 18 United States 10111. The court found that the jury had properly entered death sentences on either count, and therefore the death sentence could stand on either count. We just didn't get two. So the court vacated both and remanded them to the district, vacated the convictions and sentences and remanded to the district court with specific instructions that the government was to choose a count and the district court was to re-enter the death penalty on either count that the government chose. So at this time, at the time Mr. Rogofsky testified, although the convictions had been vacated, the court had found that there was sufficient evidence to support either conviction and that a death penalty was to be imposed on either sentence, just whichever one we chose.
So what was the jury told?
I beg your pardon,
what specifically was the jury told?
The jury was asked three questions with respect to this, and I have them right here. The first question on impeachment was, okay, and then back on July 16th of 2004 in the Eastern District of Texas, you were convicted of murder by a federal prisoner serving a life sentence. Is that correct? Mr. Rogofsky responded, that's correct. The prosecutor then said, and you were also convicted in a second count of murder in the first degree. Is that right? And Rogofsky says, that's correct. The prosecutor then says, and you received a death sentence. Is that correct? Mr. Rogofsky says, yes, I received death sentences on each count. That was the total of the cross-examination on this point. The court had pointed out to Mr. Jackson's counsel that they could bring out on redirect, or I suppose on direct, the actual status of the appeal in Mr. Rogofsky's case. And Mr. Morrow declined to do any redirect on the point. So that was a very, as we put in our brief, unsensational and short part of the cross-examination on Mr. Rogofsky. Also, Mr. Rogofsky had filed a petition for writ of certiorari on October the 17th of 2006. His testimony took place on October 26th of 2006. So his petition for writ of cert had been filed shortly before he testified. I believe if someone had asked Mr. Rogofsky if his cases were on appeal, he would have said yes, because he was still contesting, actually, this panel's opinion in his petition for writ of cert. So he believed that the case was still on appeal, and we believe that was the correct, we believe he would have believed that his case was on appeal, and the trial court, we believe, properly believed that the case was still on appeal.
What about this argument, though, about the presumption of regularity that sort of inheres in 609E about the pendency of appeal, then being applied to our ruling in the Rogofsky case to say, well, our ruling was correct then, vacating the sentence, albeit to go back and enter only one. Is that an analysis that we should employ here to say, well, it wasn't proper to get into two capital murders when we know at least one of them is gone?
By filing a petition for writ of certiorari, Mr. Rogofsky was challenging this panel's opinion. So he was actually calling that into question. And I think that is the purpose of Rule 609E, is to give a presumption of regularity to a district court opinion until the appeal is final. And the appeal was not final, even though this court had vacated both of the convictions. Mr. Rogofsky was still challenging those. And the Supreme Court could have said, no, the panel got it wrong. So I guess we're looking at whether the panel opinion had a presumption of regularity. Also significant, although we do recognize that this is a very odd situation, but the panel had essentially found that either conviction was supported by the evidence. I think Rule 609 contemplates that any sort of an unusual status an appellate status can be brought out on cross-examination or on redirect.
So is your, I guess what I'm trying, and I don't know what's wrong with my microphone. Can you hear me okay? Is your argument that there was no error because pendency of appeal means we just go with what the district court did until the appeal is final? Or is your argument that it's harmless error because in the end, one conviction is a big enough deal that if there's going to be impeachment value to it, one versus two wouldn't be the difference. It's two versus none is my interchange with your opposing counsel.
Your Honor, our argument here is that the case was still on appeal because the petition of cert per cert made the conviction still on appeal. Obviously, the appellate status can be disclosed to the jury, but the case, the United States does argue that there was no error because the case was still on appeal, and we do believe, although there is no case law on the specific point, that the parallels that we cited in our brief, the way that the Supreme Court considers cases pending on direct review, as well as this court's jurisprudence on collateral review, would indicate that a petition for certiorari makes a case still on direct review, still on appeal, and that is what is contemplated by Rule 609E. Now, alternately, we do believe that if this court were to find an error, that the error was indeed harmless. There was significant or substantial evidence regarding Mr. Jackson's guilt. Mr. Rogofsky was simply one in a parade of inmate witnesses. The jury in the rest of Mr. Rogofsky's cross-examination heard about the murder that actually landed him in federal prison. He had robbed a bank and murdered the bank president in the course of that robbery in a pretty horrific way. And that was also before the jury, although not in a particularly sensational fashion. So Mr. Rogofsky was cross-examined on points other than this. We're looking at three questions of cross-examination in a long trial, and one that did involve a significant amount of proof regarding Mr. Jackson's guilt. And we believe that in this context, there is simply no reason to believe that that particular cross-examinant, Mr. Rogofsky, actually tipped the scales in favor of guilt on Mr. Jackson's part.
So you think it's harmless error not because of the one versus two versus none issue, but just because you think in the sum total of the trial it didn't make a difference?
Exactly, Your Honor. I do believe that is the correct way to evaluate, under the jurisprudence of this court, the correct way to evaluate the harmless error in this case. I see that I've consumed most of my time. Unless the court has any further questions on any of Mr. Jackson's other issues, we will submit those as briefed and respectfully urge the court to affirm the conviction and the sentence in this case in all respects.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kenner. Mr. Barlow, you save time for rebuttal.
I just have two brief comments that I'd like to point out regarding the pretrial delay. There is a remedy without reversing the convictions of this court could remand for some type of an in-camera hearing so we could get an answer to the questions that we've asked all along. We've suggested why they did it, and no one's actually testified about why they did it. No one's ever answered the questions of, did you file a weapons charge just to put the weapon in the hand of the defendant? They've never been required to answer that, and it could be remanded to get to that answer.
You gave at least me the impression in your opening argument that the government had not offered any reasons, and Ms. Kenner referred to the written submission the government had made giving three reasons. So
That's correct in their written response, Your Honor. I was pointing out that at the pretrial hearing when we had discussions about it, the prosecution has elected on each occasion to say we don't have a response to the allegation about the weapons, why we filed a weapons charge. And that's the real issue. Why did they file the weapons charge when they had 4 years to investigate it and then dismiss it later, other than obvious trial tactic? And that's the answer. That's the question that we've wanted answered.
But I guess to me that is not pertinent unless it's part of a prejudicial delay. In other words, I understand the idea of if they had somehow snookered Mr. Jackson into pleading guilty and then used that against him, how that would be some sort of allegation of prosecutorial misconduct or something of that nature. But as you pointed out, he didn't plead guilty. So their motivations in filing it, I guess I'm wondering how that
plays out here. Your argument is delay. It's not that we need to somehow sanction the prosecutor's office for how they conduct their business or something like that.
Well,
so I'm trying to understand why the motive in filing the weapons charge by itself is the key factor here.
Because one of the important factors is if the government has bad faith and why they waited 6 years to prosecute him for a capital murder. And that's what we submit is one
but
of the
But would the filing the weapons charge to try to get an overall plea that they could use necessarily prove that the delay, in other words, I'm just wondering why the motive for the weapons charge proves something about the delay, unless you just want to say they're bad people all the time and this proves that.
No, I just think that would contribute to the overall scenario of why they didn't file the capital murder case after they concluded their investigation, and Mr. Jackson would have had his mother alive at the time of that trial rather than the way it turned out. And regarding the other issue that we've raised here, there were a few more questions too that were asked. For on page 71 of the government's brief, sets out that the prosecutor in questioning Mr. Rogowski even pointed out Mr. Beatty, Joe Beatty over here, one of the prosecutors. He was one of the prosecutors that helped put you on death row. The government was then allowed to argue not just that those reversed convictions were good for impeachment purposes, but it also shows that Mr. Rogowski must be lying because he had some animosity towards Mr. Beatty because he was the one that prosecuted him and put him on death row. And those reverse convictions allowed them in final, as I recall, I believe in final argument, they even made that argument that Mr. Rogowski must be lying also because Mr. Beatty, he's mad at the prosecutor that put him on death row. So it wasn't just impeachment, it was to show that, another motive to for Mr. Rogowski to be lying.
Ms. Kenner indicated that Judge Crone gave you the opportunity to conduct a redirect on Agofsky to point out the specific legal status of the appeals, and you declined that opportunity. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, and for several reasons. One is we thought the less we talked about those, the better. Secondly, we didn't think that the fact that they'd been reversed would, we don't like talking about appeals and things in front of juries, and in fact, that relates to one of our other issues about the motion for new trial, because the jury heard that one of the other witnesses for the government had gotten his sentence reduced drastically, and so some of the jurors thought, well, Mr. Jackson might be able to do that. We don't want a jury to be thinking, well, he got his death sentences reversed, Mr. Jackson might get his death sentence reversed, so we don't have to be too concerned about what we do here. That's why we didn't want to talk about it any more than we did.
All right, Mr. Barlow. Your case is under submission. We notice that you're court appointed, and we wish to thank you for your willingness to take the appointment. You've done a good job on behalf of your client.
I thank the court.
Next case, Securities and Exchange.